How will climate change affect what you eat and what you'll pay for it? In the hour to come, we're going to look into the future of food. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Fred Kirschman. He is a Leopold Center Distinguished Fellow. He has received international recognition for his writing on sustainable agriculture and land ethics. Welcome to University of the Air.
My pleasure.
We hear this term, sustainable agriculture, from time to time, and it's one I think we need to renew the definition of it. It may actually have changed a little bit over the years.
Yeah, and it needs to change some more. I think that one of the problems with our current use of sustainable agriculture is for whether you're a farmer or anyone else in the food, or even not even, well, everybody's in the food system, but even if you're not actively engaged in the food system, we tend to think of sustainability in terms of how do we green up the current system a little bit to make it a little less bad. And given the challenges we're going to face in the future, it's not going to be sustainable.
The goal for a long time seems to have been to get the maximum return in a minimum period of time. Is that going to have to go by the wayside?
Well, yeah, it's, our agriculture is really modeled after our industrial economy, which is all of our industrial economy is really operated on the notion of maximum efficient production for short-term economic return. And it's generally understood whether you're manufacturing computers or producing food or whatever, if you aren't accomplishing that objective, then you're just not going to be in business very long. And the problem with that is that the kind of challenges we're going to be facing in the future are not going to be solved with short-term return. They're going to be solved with putting together systems that are resilient under some very difficult circumstances. And so that's a shift that we have to make in our thinking, I think.
One of the difficult circumstances would seem to be climate change, where it becomes really hard to predict what your growing season is going to be like and what to expect. Yeah. Is that going to change, I think it's fair to use the word, the design of crops?
Yeah, I think it's going to change the design of how we grow our food, because you know, when you think about, and I think climatologists are pretty much agreed that you can't predict how climate change is going to play itself out in any particular place. So if I have a farm in North Dakota, I can't predict exactly how that's going to affect my farm. But one of the things that that we can predict is that climate's going to be more unstable. In fact, my friend David Orr says we shouldn't call it climate warming. We should call it climate weirdness.
Everybody would agree, I think. I keep hearing that word.
Yeah, so it's the uncertainty, really, that that's going to and we know, I think, some things about it. It's you're going to have more severe weather events, more droughts,
more floods. Severe than it usually is in North Dakota? Even more severe than it usually is in North Dakota?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, aren't a lot of crops engineered now, genetically engineered for a very specific climate and a very specific set of circumstances? Is that going to have to change?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we hear a lot about, well, we can deal with climate change because we're going to develop more drought-resistant crops. Well, more drought-resistant crops will probably help in a drought period, but they're not going to help when you've got too much rain. You know, on our own farm in North Dakota, for example, this summer we've had exceptional amounts of rain. We couldn't get in to harvest our crop because it rained every other day. And so drought-resistant crops wouldn't help you with that.
Not too much. Well, and that gets into a groundwater situation too, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's not just the crops, obviously. It's the soil.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, from my perspective, restoring the biological health of our soil is one of the critical things that we need to do now, because we haven't attended to that. Because, again, in our industrial economy approach, we were looking for that short-term return, and the best way you get a short-term return is you put the inputs into the soil that you need in order to get that short-term return. But those inputs are also going to become less available because you know, for almost 100 years now, we've been depleting all those resources. You know, there are only four countries that still have rock phosphate reserves, only four that still have potash reserves.
Really?
And so, you know, those costs are going to continue to go up. And then, of course, as we all know, at some point, our fossil fuels will get to depleted to a point where they're not going to become affordable anymore. So you don't have all those resources as the inputs to produce your food, then we're going to have to really rely on some of the natural resources like biologically healthy soils.
Well, I thought that, you know, back in elementary school, we were all taught about crop rotation and leaving portions of land fallow to recover and all that. Has that not been practiced for the last 50 years or more?
No, and, you know, fallow isn't necessarily an entirely positive thing either, but there was at least a sense that you had to somehow restore what you were taking out of the land. But once all of the cheap fertilizers had become available, that concept kind of disappeared because we could always go buy some more and they were affordable, and you put those inputs in and then you get a good crop. So why mess with crop rotations? So we went to more monocultures. And again, if you think about it in terms of maximum efficient production for short-term economic return, how do you do that? Well, again, whether you're doing automobiles or computers or food, you want to specialize because complex systems tend to become more difficult to manage. You want to simplify your management as much as possible because that increases your efficiencies. And you want to go for economies of scale. And so if you look at our landscape now, in any industrialized country, you're going to see, like in Iowa, for example, 92% of our cultivated land is in just two crops, corn and soybeans. That's the specialization. And then farmers use the technologies which simplify their management. So you use a herbicide-resistant seed, which then allows you to simply plant your crop, wait till the weeds come up, and then put on your herbicide, and the crop survives and thrives well, and your weeds are gone. So, you know, that's and then the farms get bigger and bigger because every farmer understands if you aren't getting bigger, then somehow you're not successful.
Is there really a connection between size and success?
Well, there is, but, you know, it's interesting what the reasons for that are. You know, the conventional wisdom had always been that, you know, first of all, if you look at the data, the farms that were losing at the fastest rate have been for the last 20 years or so are the mid-sized farms.
Not the small ones? Are they already gone?
Well, the small ones are mostly now doing direct marketing, and so they have that advantage. And then the larger farms, of course, are doing the ones that are doing the undifferentiated commodities. And the conventional wisdom always was that the small farms simply aren't as efficient as the big farms, and
right. That's
why we're losing them. Well, Mike Duffy, who's an ag economist at Iowa State University, he was always a little suspicious about that conclusion. And so, I don't know, about 6 or 7 years ago, he did an on-farm study in Iowa to see whether that was actually true. And what he found was that farms indeed got more efficient as they got bigger, but only up to a certain point. What he found in Iowa was that when farms reached their peak efficiency at about 600 to 900 acres, which most everybody would say is a mid-sized family farm. In market hog operation, they reached their peak efficiency at 1,200 market hogs a year, which again would be considered a mid-sized family farm. So why were we losing them when they were, in fact, as farms got bigger than that, they didn't get more efficient and some, in fact, started to lose efficiencies? And I never understood the answer to that dilemma until, I don't know, it was about 6 or 7 years ago when Rick Schneiders was still the CEO of the Cisco Corporation. And as a food service company, he began to recognize that the future of food service was in these differentiated food products. Consumers wanted food. As he put it, it's not about fast, convenient, and cheap anymore. It's about memory, romance, and trust.
Memory, romance, and trust.
Right. What he meant by that was he said, you want to have a product out there that is so good that when your customer eats it, they say, wow, where did that come from? I want that again. That's that memory part.
Sure.
And then he said they not only want that kind of quality product, they also want a good story that comes with it. That's the romance part.
Really?
Some want to know where the food came from. Some want to know who the farmer was that produced it. Some want to know there was good environmental stewardship all the way from the farm to the table. Some want to know the animals were treated right. They have different stories, but they all want a good story that comes with it. They want to feel good about it, not only love the good quality, but feel good about it. And then he said they also don't want to have to worry about things anymore, so they want a trusting relationship, and that's the trust part. So his point was that the big farms, the big commodity farms, weren't going to supply those differentiated products with the good quality and the story and the trusting relationship because they already had invested too much in the current situation. And the small farms who are doing direct marketing, like farmers markets and CSAs, et cetera, they couldn't meet the scale at which the kind of, you know, the product that he needed for his company. And so he said it's the mid-sized farms, which are the farms of food service. So he organized a meeting in Marshalltown, Iowa, in which he invited some farmers, people from the food industry like Cargill and ConAgra, some people from the university like myself. And as you would expect from Rick, he started the meeting that evening over a dinner where we all sat around a table. And it turned out, I think quite by accident, that I sat next to one of the head meat marketers from Cargill. And when he found out I was from the Leopold Center and we had done some research about mid-sized farms, he turned to me and he says, "So what do you think's the future of family farms?" And I said, "Well, if you look at the data, if we don't do anything different, give it another 10, 15 years and we're going to lose most of them." And then he said, "I think you're right." And then he said, "Well, what about the big farms?" And I said, "Well, again, if you look at the data, it would appear that as long as they can get bigger and learn to operate on thinner margins, they'll still be okay, but someday they'll also be in trouble." And then he turned to me and said, "I think you're right. As a matter of fact, we can't make a profit selling to Walmart anymore." And I turned to him and I said, "Wait a minute, you're Cargill." And then he said, "Yeah, but you don't understand it." And he wasn't singling out Walmart. What he was talking about was concentration at the retail level now. And he said, "The concentration at the retail level now is so intense that when a company like Walmart needs a new product, they'll go out to seven or eight of us, companies like Cargill, who can provide that product at the scale that they need it. And they'll say, 'Here's a new product that we need. Now give us your best price.'"
Sure, put it out to bid.
Right. And so he said, "Obviously, none of us want to lose an account like that, so we all sharpen our pencils and cut our margins as much as we can and offer a price." And then he said, "They'll pick three of us, and they'll come back to us, and they'll say, 'Okay, you're in the running now. Now give us your real price.'" So he said, "We can't cut our margins anymore. We've already done that. So the only thing we can do," he said, "is to cut our transaction costs." And he said, "The easiest way for us to do that is to just buy from the biggest farmers." Because as he put it, he said, "It's cheaper for us to buy 10,000 hogs from one farmer than to buy 1,000 hogs from 10 farmers. So that's what we have to do." So there was the answer to the problem. It was that the concentration now at the retail level is such that they pretty much dictate the price they're going to pay, which then dictates what the farmers get. And the mid-sized farmers no longer get the preferential contracts. They become the residual suppliers where they'll buy their product if they need it, and they won't if they don't. And that's what's putting them out of business.
So they literally are caught in the middle.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
And it's agribusiness getting bigger than at the top, at least to the point where that margin is sustainable?
Well, that's a really good question because, my personal view is that these concentrations work okay, at least for those companies, so long as they continue to have relatively cheap energy and all the other things which drives the industrial economy. But what's going to happen when crude oil gets to $300 a barrel?
Despite the reserves in North Dakota?
Yeah, right. I mean, at some point it's going to happen because the rate we're increasingly using. And then, of course, you get other things tied in, which we can go into if you want to. But, you know, the more we burn more oil, the more we precipitate climate change. So
That's true. There's a cycle department.
Right. Yeah. And, the most recent International Panel on Climate Change report, which came out in late March, they're now saying we only have about 15 years to put a cap on carbon. So that's not a long time.
And if you don't use carbon, what do you use?
Well, that's the thing. See, this is why we need to start looking at nature's resources. You know, like if you have a biologically healthy soil, and one of the pieces of good news from my point of view is that farmers are beginning to recognize that they can restore the biological health of their soil by incorporating cover crops in their typical corn-soybean rotation, for example. And when they do that, they not only restore the biological health of their soil, but they can reduce the amount of fertilizer and pesticide that they need to use. Some farmers have now demonstrated when they consistently include a cover crop in their rotation over a period of 6 to 7 years, they can reduce their fertilizer and pesticide input by 70%, still maintain their yields, and the quality of their soil improves to a point where instead of their soil only absorbing a half inch of rainfall an hour, which is where most of our soils are at now because they're so degraded, they now absorb 8 inches of rainfall an hour. So now, again, if you think about more droughts and more floods, you know, it's not that you have to hope it's going to be just droughts because you got these drought-resistant crops, but you're going to have both. So during flooding periods, your soil absorbs much more moisture, so there's less flooding damage to the community and for nutrient runoff from your fields into the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
It's evened out. You're saying you have a reserve of moisture
right,
in the soil
exactly,
to get you
right.
through the drier times.
Right. But it also absorbs more of the water during the flooding times so that you don't have the damage from the flooding and also the damage from soil erosion, et cetera.
I'm still kind of surprised that this wasn't all pretty much covered back, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s with crop rotation. I mean, we heard about, you know, you plant a certain crop here to replenish the nitrogen in the soil or whatever
well,
it was
you
lacking.
Well, you know, we had, as I look back on it anyway now, we had some people of wisdom back then. You know, you had people like Aldo Leopold. You had people like Liberty Hyde Bailey, you know, that said, Liberty Hyde Bailey said, we have to get a new hold on agriculture. You know, we got to recognize the gifts of nature and restore those and, you know, keep them alive. You know, it's a holy earth, as he put it. But, of course, having all of these, especially after the Second World War, all of these cheap inputs which farmers could put in the field, and suddenly, you know, you had these increases of yields on your hand.
Not to mention good old DDT.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so it was just too sexy, you know, to pay attention to the Liberty Hyde Baileys, you know.
And there was an assumption that they energy sources would be
always be there.
Infinite.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Well, what about then alternate energy sources? Now, I'm assuming, Fred, that if we have soil that is not as depleted of the key elements and also the water, that you wouldn't need to invest as much energy to, you know, irrigate it and that kind of thing.
Right.
But still, as you say, we've got 15 years to get a cap on those carbon-based right. energy sources. What are our options?
Well, that's a really that's probably the critical question, and I think that we've had some people of wisdom that have helped us to understand what the options are. The difficulty now, I think, is that we have made, and especially farmers, have made huge investments in this current approach and this current system, and so it's very difficult. And the other thing about it is that, as of the 2007 census data, and we haven't unpacked all of the 2012 census data yet, but as of 2007 census data, 30% of our farmers in the United States now are over age 65. So you imagine that you're over age 65, you have spent your whole life investing in exactly what we told them we wanted. We wanted our food fast, convenient, and cheap, and that's exactly what they gave us. And now that they're 65, they're supposed to make major changes.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to happen. Again, I think the good news is that the young farmers, although there aren't many of them in the system yet, and the more middle-aged farmers who know they've got another 20 or 30 years ahead of them, they're the ones that are really interested in trying to figure out how they make the necessary changes. And you've got some interesting farm organizations now all across the country where farmers are coming together and trying to figure this out. You got Practical Farmers of Iowa in Iowa. You got the Moses Group here in Wisconsin. You've got the Northern Plains Sustainable Agriculture Society in the Northern Plains. So they're all over the country. And if you go to their meetings, these are mostly young and middle-aged farmers. And, you know, they're coming up with at least some short-term creative ideas for how to begin moving in the right direction. And, again, I think that the cover crop phenomenon, which is starting to take off, I see at least as a transition strategy, which begins to move in the right direction.
And these are crops that are marketable too, I assume, not just
that's another interesting question because they haven't been seen as being marketable, but, you know, and depending on where you are, but if you're in Wisconsin or Iowa, you don't plant corn and soybeans in 2 years and then plant your cover crop the third year, you plant your cover crop the same year that you plant the corn and soybeans. And there's some creative ways now that they're using to plant your cover crop into the corn or the soybeans before harvest.
Well, that's what I was wondering. So it's literally in the same land.
Right. And so what happens then is that instead of having green growing plants on your land for 3 or 4 months, it's more like 7 or 8 months. And that, of course, sequesters more carbon, restores the biological health of your soil, and over a period of time you can reduce the amount of inputs that you have to buy. So those are all very positive things, and farmers are beginning to recognize that. And even some of our big farmers now are starting to plant cover crops. It's not a huge movement yet, but it has some real potential.
And what sort of crops would those be?
There are mixtures of crops, and Natural Resources Conservation Service now has become a big advocate of the cover crops, and so they actually now have a website that you can go on. And a farmer can say, okay, I live in such and such a county in Wisconsin, and this is what my farm is like. And then it will give you a suggestion of the kind of mixture of cover crops that's the best mixture for you in that region.
I have a question about water, and we're going to get to that in this story of sustainable agriculture when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Fred Kirschman. He is with the Leopold Center, and he is telling us about sustainable agriculture in a time of climate change and other changes in the situation that affects farmers. And, of course, that means it affects us, everyone who eats at least. In these times where recently there have been so many droughts in California, for example, water increasingly becomes an issue, but it has been raised for at least 30 years. There was a book called Cadillac Desert that spoke in great length in the 1980s about the depletion of the Oglala Aquifer, which is the water source for a huge part of the Midwest and the Rocky Mountain states, for example, and the changes that are going to have to be made in order somehow to accommodate that. So what do you do to sustain this agriculture in a place that doesn't have an ongoing source of plentiful water?
Yeah, well, one of the things we have here, I think, is a very serious cultural problem. We still have this kind of culture that water is free. It's, unlimited, and so you can use as much as you want. You don't have to worry about conservation. You can waste it, whatever you want to do. And we're at the point now where we're beginning to recognize that that's not the case, because part of it is because with the impact of climate change, again, as we said, we have more floods and more droughts. And during the drought periods, of course, and, you know, California is a good example. I had the opportunity to visit Tom Wiley's farm, who was one of the first organic vegetable growers in California. And he told us, and his region of California, they have these irrigation channels, which are made out of cement. And from the beginning of the growing season, you have water coming into those irrigation channels, primarily from snowpack in the mountains. Well, now this year, there was no snowpack, and so there was no water in the spring. Now, normally what Tom and his neighbors would do is they'd get their water out of the irrigation channel for the first 5 or 6 months out of the year, and then eventually it would dry up, and then you'd get the water from beneath the ground.
From wells.
From the wells, from pumping from the wells. So this year they all had a pump from the wells from the beginning. And so we visited his farm at the end of July, and he said at the end of July they had already found that they had drawn down the water in their wells by 15 feet this year.
15 feet, that's considerable. And, we hear about, the Oglala Aquifer, which took, some tens of thousands of years to build up its water supply and has been drawn down in the last 100 years or less, 40,000 years worth of water.
Yeah, it's a fossil aquifer, meaning that, you know, you can restore it, but only at a very slow rate. And we've been depleting it. Essentially, we've depleted the Ogallala aquifer by half since 1960.
Since 1960.
Right. And even some of the farms on the edges of the Ogallala aquifer already have had to give up irrigation because they can't go down that deep anymore. The other problem with the Ogallala more recently now, and there have been two studies that have been done, one by Kansas State University. I don't remember who did the other study, but there were two studies done to see how, at the rate that we're drawing down the water now, and they both concluded that at the rate we're drawing down the water in the Ogallala now, it's only going to have irrigation water for another 20 years.
So you combine that with
California.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, well, and of course, the poor beleaguered Colorado River.
Right.
As a source of drinking water, I think agricultural water too.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Water is about as basic as it gets.
That's right. That's
for
right.
what you need to grow food. What are the options there? You can't create it.
Well, again, from my perspective, and again, this isn't just happening in the United States, it's happening throughout the world. I mean, the water levels in places like India and Africa have been drawn down dramatically, China as well. And so we have to, first of all, come to terms with the fact that water is a limited resource, and we have to really begin conserving our use of water. A lot of my friends, they don't have any reservation at all about taking a shower for an hour and a half. Well, you know, that's probably not something that we should be thinking about doing in the future. But here again is where the biological health of soil becomes so important, because if you've got soil that absorbs 8 inches of rainwater an hour, then you're not going to need nearly as much irrigation. And also, you know, much of our irrigation is really wasteful irrigation with the center pivots, et cetera. You know, drip irrigation is one method that, especially on a small scale, requires much less water. But if you have biologically healthy soil, you know, it absorbs so much more of that rainfall and holds it, so you don't need to irrigate as often. And that, I think, again, is I think restoring the biological health of our soil is one of the key issues that we have to really address now. And we know how to do that. This is not a mystery.
And we can do that without a lot of phosphates and pesticides?
That's right. That's right. You know, and, you know, Sir Albert Howard, back in the 1940s, in his book, An Agriculture Testament, already articulated this. He said that what we need to do is to farm like nature does. Nature doesn't do monocultures. Nature doesn't use a lot of inputs, and there's no waste in nature. He articulated the concept of the law of return. Everything that we take from the soil, we need to restore to the soil, whether that's in the form of compost or any other means. Nature also doesn't do monocultures. It does mixtures of plants and animals. He starts out his summation statement by saying, Mother Earth never farms without livestock, so livestock are always a part of it.
Really? Livestock in the sense of large herds of cattle and large supplies of pigs, for example?
Well, I'm not even sure that large is the right concept here, but that you have this, you know, like, again, in nature, you don't have usually don't have large concentrations of animals in one place. If you do, they tend to, you know, Aldo Leopold made a comment about this, that nature abhors the density of any species. And he said, when any species becomes dense, nature finds a way to reduce that density. And if one system fails, she'll find another.
That's true. I mean,
but you have this incorporated. In other words, animals are always an integral part of a healthy nature, of a healthy system. And part of that is because the animals help to close that nutrient cycle, you know, so that the urine and the manure from the animals feed the microbes in the soil, enriches the soil where the soil produces more grass for the animals, kind of thing. So those are some of the systems, I think, that we have to think about restoring.
And do you have a sense of how long it would take before we have a significant reduction in the amount of irrigation we need to do
That's the critical issue. And I think right now, even within the sustainable agriculture movement, in my humble opinion, we're not really facing up yet to the major challenges that we have to address. We're still thinking if we just kind of tweak the current system a little bit, we'll all be okay. And that's a concept which Thomas Eagleman, who was the president of the World Watch Institute, and they publish a report each year called the State of the World Report. In the State of the World Report for 2013, he wrote the opening essay in which he coined the term sustainababble, which I always thought was a great description of how we're looking at this. And then he said that we're now in what he called a state of dreamy belief, because we think if we just kind of, you know, tweak the edges a little bit, then everything will turn out okay. And that's simply not the case. So first thing we have to do is we have to come to terms with the incredible challenges that we're going to be facing, and then really put a lot of our creative brain energy, you know, into how we address those. And I think my own view is that if we were to take some of the wisdom from the past, from people like Sir Albert Howard and Aldo Leopold and Liberty Hyde Bailey, I mean, there are a number, there's a whole group of individuals that really address these issues. So there's that wisdom from the past, and if we took that and we married that with the science of ecology and evolutionary biology, which they did not have at their disposal, we do now. And then I think we could create the alternative systems that could at least move us in the right direction. And then the critical issue is, again, given the International Panel on Climate Change projections that we only have 15 years, is how rapidly can we introduce this? Because as climatologists are telling us, you know, we reach that tipping point. If we cross that threshold, then, you know, we can't go back and redo things anymore, because the whole climate of the planet changes to a point where it may simply not be favorable to the human species. And that's the big crisis that we got to deal with.
Assuming that it's consistent from one administration to the next, what part is the Department of Agriculture playing in this thinking?
Well, that's another – you've got some really great questions, and they're the critical ones. And my own view is that – well, first of all, there's two things about that. Currently, the policies in the Department of Agriculture – and I don't mean this critically. It's simply a reality. It's simply a fact of life right now. The policies which USDA is promoting are those which are favorable to the current vested interests, because they have the money to make the campaign contributions, et cetera. So they pretty much dictate what USDA comes up with. But on the other hand, we have these huge populations of people in our urban communities now, which increasingly realize that the food system is broken and it isn't providing them what they want. And so they want to see changes. And I think at some point, politicians, and to some extent it's already happening, where politicians are paying as much attention to these populations of voting people as they are to the vested interests. And my own assessment is that sometime over the next 10 years, you're going to see those kind of balance off. Then I think you're going to see the potential for some creative new policies coming out of USDA. In the meantime, I think most of the changes are going to come from the bottom up.
You don't think the vested interests are going to realize that, well, gosh, we may be doing great this year, but in 5 or 10 years, it's really to our advantage to change this somehow?
That's another really great question. I don't know the answer to that. One hopes that that will be the case. But, you know, again, if you think about, so, and I don't mean this isn't just farmers. This is the input suppliers. This is the food processing companies. You know, they've all made these huge investments. And their behavior, at least in the last 100 years or so, has been what's going to be good for them in the short term is what they're going to fight for. And if they continue to do that, then it's going to prolong the recognition of the kinds of changes that we need to make. So we don't know for sure. I'm more hopeful right now about the kinds of changes that we're seeing, again, from the bottom up. You know, there are not only throughout the United States, but actually throughout the world now, there are a growing number of people that I call food citizens. You know, these are people who want to see changes, and they want to have more of a voice. You know, the whole notion of food sovereignty, of, you know, communities being able to make the decisions about where the food's going to come from, how it's going to be produced, et cetera, for their own communities. And so you start to have, and some people call them food hubs, some call them food sheds after a watershed. But we got these communities of people now who are really, really making an impact and having an influence in their own communities in terms of what happens. And some of my friends who are looking at this now, they're envisioning at some point in the future, and again, you know, how far in the future, I don't know, but that the whole homogenized global food system eventually is going to disappear because you're not going to have the cheap energy and all that that sustained it. And then in its place, you're going to have these regional food citizen groups that are going to have their own food system in their own community. But, you know, if you have a food hub in North Dakota, probably North Dakotans are going to still want to drink coffee and they can't raise coffee beans. So with Twitter and Facebook and all these communication systems, they're going to be in communication with a food hub probably in Brazil to get their coffee beans. In exchange, they'll send them some wheat, you know, for what they need.
Cause so you're saying hub to hub or individual to hub?
Hub to hub, yeah, uh-huh. Hub to hub. So you have a global system of these networks all in communication with each other through the communications network that we have. So
some considerable decentralizing.
Yes, yeah, definitely, yeah.
And you wouldn't just be likely to go into your Cops or your Century and find apples from New Zealand.
No. And in fact, you wouldn't have the big supermarkets. You know, you would have more, you know, these networks of stores, you know, who are, again, in direct communication with the farmers who are part of the hub and featuring, you know, their food.
Welcome back to the 19th century.
Well, in a way, it's back to the 19th century in terms of not having these huge, concentrated, powerful corporations. But it wouldn't be back to the 19th century in terms of, you know, how the food was grown and stuff because,
sure.
Again, we don't have those resources anymore. So,
what about the role of not livestock so much at this point, but, you know, other things that might have been at one point considered pests in the whole, you know, biosphere of the farm? Has that changed at all?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and again, there's we're in the early stages of the change, but there's an interesting person from Europe who wrote a book several years ago called Meat, a Benign Extravagance. And I've always loved the way he approached the issue because he looks at how we put our food system together from the point of view of if we eat in a particular way, what would that do to the health of the community in which we live? By the community, meaning the natural community. So he selects different ways that we could select to eat. If everybody ate in a particular way, what would that do? And so, I'm going to use two different examples from his book. And one is he says, if everybody became a vegan, what would that do to the communities in which we live?
Good question.
And then he says, well, if everybody became a vegan, then we wouldn't have any animals. Therefore, we wouldn't have animal manure as part of the nutrients going back into the soil, which would mean we'd need more fertilizer. And if you use more fertilizer, you're going to have more nitrous oxide, which is a problem. And you would be relying on a resource which is in a state of depletion into the future, again, because it's not going to be there forever. And then what are you going to do? And he says, you'd have to raise a lot more alfalfa, but if you don't have any animals, what are you going to do with the alfalfa? So what I like about his approach is this very pragmatic, what are the pragmatic implications of if we all eat in a particular way? And that doesn't mean that some of us shouldn't have the right to be vegans if they want to be. He's simply saying, you know, sometimes people say, well, if everybody did this, then we'd solve all the problems. And that's
right.
Really what
wouldn't
he takes issue with. And then he has another section in which he says, if everybody ate as much meat as we do in the industrial world, what impact would that have? And, of course, you know, I don't even need to go into the details about some of the negative aspects of that, not only in terms of our own health, but in terms of, the health of the communities in which we live.
The intensity it takes to grow meat as opposed vegetables beef versus... chickens, for example.
Right. Yeah. And that's why he titles his book Meat, a Benign Extravagance, that meat plays a critical role, the animals play a critical role in the health of the system, but if you overdo it, if it's an extravagance, then you start to have negative consequences from that. So again, it's looking, you know, and this is where, again, I think some of the wisdom from the past is, you know, looking at how nature does it and then mimicking that as much as possible in our agriculture system. I think that's the wisdom, really, that we have to try to incorporate more and more.
Well, I have some questions about your own farming practices and then this whole urban farming movement as well as the organic phenomenon that's been with us for a while. We'll look at those right after this. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Fred Kirschman, who is with the Leopold Center, and he's also traditionally a large-scale farmer, or actually maybe he'll fine-tune that in a moment, but it sounds pretty large to me. And we're talking about the whole concept of sustainable agriculture, especially in times of depleted energy resources, depleted water resources, and climate change. As if those three weren't enough, we have some other issues too, of course. Now, you have this family farm in North Dakota, right, Fred, and 3,500 acres. Would that be considered a large or medium-sized farm?
Well, in North Dakota, it's at best a medium-sized farm, probably a small farm. You know, some of the farms in North Dakota now are 15 and 20,000 acres.
And so are you, what kind of things do you grow there? And are you feeling this pinch that we talked about earlier that the medium-sized farmers are feeling?
Yeah, well, one of the things, and first of all, our farm is smaller now because my sister and I had at one point co-owned the farm, and that's when it was 3,500 acres. And then she turned 80 years old and decided that she wanted out. So, you know, she sold her half of the farm. So we're at about 1,900 acres now. And in a lot of places, that sounds like a big farm, but it's in North Dakota, it's definitely a small farm now. And, you know, it's one of the currently, one of the advantages of farming organically is that the prices that you get paid for your production are quite a bit higher than in conventional agriculture.
You just have to get the consumer to pay out the extra.
Well, yeah, it's strictly a supply demand situation, and demand is greater than the supply, and so, you know, the prices go up. I don't like the idea of the prices getting too high because I don't think they're, quote, sustainable in the long term. And so we've developed a long-term relationship with a company called Rockwell Organic, which is located out in Connecticut, and they buy our grain on the farm and then get it processed, get it cleaned and bagged or however their customers want it, and then get it to their customers. And we always agree on a price that we both can live with, and it's not always the highest price. But nevertheless, you know, even now we're getting like $18 a bushel for hard red organic spring wheat. And, you know, conventional prices now are around $5 or $6. So, you know, that's a big difference.
It is.
And getting those kinds of prices is definitely a part of what makes our farm sustainable right now. But the other thing is that, you know, we don't have to buy fertilizer, so we don't buy a lot of those inputs, which are increasingly getting more expensive.
As organic farmers.
Right, yeah. And but we do have the expense of spreading our compost and, you know, those kinds of things. So those are expenses that conventional farmers don't have. But nevertheless, our input costs are quite a bit less than what a conventional farm would be. So those are the things that are, you know, quote, sustaining us at this moment. But it's also very clear to me that, you know, I one of the ways I like to frame things, not only for myself and my own farm, but for all of us as farmers, is, you know, let's assume that 10 years from now, crude oil will be $300 a barrel. Now, I didn't come up with that number. T. Boone Pickett, who's an oil guy in Texas,
you ought to know.
2 years ago, he said we should expect crude oil to be $350 a barrel in 10 years. Now, I think he said that before, you know, the whole fracking phenomenon really took off.
Right.
And so that's keeping the prices down somewhat.
And that's as opposed to, what, about 75 or less at this point?
No, it's right around $100 a barrel.
Is it
right
that high now?
Yeah.
Okay.
And at least the oil companies in North Dakota have been saying for some time that if it gets below $100 a barrel, they can't afford to get the oil from fracking anymore because that gets below their above their costs. So let's assume that it's if it's 20 years from now, certainly by 20 years, that's likely to happen. So let's assume we're looking at a future where crude oil is $300 a barrel, where fertilizers cost five times what they do today because the costs are continually going up, where we only have, on a global basis, half the amount of fresh water that we've been used to using, and that we have twice the number of severe weather events due to climate change. And then I like to have conversations with a mixture of farmers, conventional farmers, organic farmers, local farmers, and then pose that question, and then to say, can any of you still do what you're doing under those circumstances? I have yet to find a single person, including myself, that can say, yeah, you know, we can live with that. So I think what we need to start doing now to really prepare for the future is to anticipate those possibilities And if it's 20 years from now instead of 10 years from now, that's still not a long time to make the kind of changes we need to make. But this is where I think, and, you know, fortunately on our farm, the quality of our soil has increased a lot since we've been farming organically since 1976. But I think it still can use some further improvement. And in North Dakota, doing cover crops is a little more challenging because our growing season is so short. But I think we need to really look hard at how we, you know, include some of that phenomenon. And then we have to look at how, what kind of crop rotations we use, and that, you know, for, you know, animals can do really well under those circumstances that I described with the, because you don't use a lot of energy, et cetera. So we may want to include more animals in the system than we currently have, because one of the other things, you know, at least where my farm is in North Dakota, this is in the prairie pothole region. And so a lot of the land is still in native prairie. You know, about 800 acres of our farm is still in native prairie.
And just for what, grazing? Just
for grazing, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And so the animals essentially are freebies during that period of time because they're out there grazing, sure, on that natural growth. There are wetlands in there, so there's plenty of water available for them to drink. So all we got to do is check them once in a while and make sure that there aren't any problems. So I think we have to really look at each of our ecological neighborhoods and see what's appropriate in that neighborhood under those circumstances, and then as much as possible restore the biological health of our soil so we use less water, we use less fertility because there's more fertility stored in the soil. You start to reduce all of those costs, then I think there's a possibility that we can figure out. And then we need to take more of the science of ecology and evolutionary biology and incorporate that into our agriculture, which we've barely started to do. And that science has been around now for at least 30 years.
So, do you think this urban, I'm going to call it an urban farming phenomenon, do you think that is going to become a major player?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, Richard Heinberg, who's written extensively about our future food system, you know, based on he's been studying the energy situation. So simply on the basis of energy, he has drawn the conclusion, and there's some good news, bad news here, but the good news is he argues that the unsettling of America, you know, people leaving the farms and going to urban communities.
The Midwest and Virginia.
Right. All of that happened with the industrial economy. As the industrial economy starts to crash because of the lack of cheap energy, you're going to have what he calls the re-ruralization of America. So he sees by the year he said by the year 2040, he expects that we're going to have 40 to 50 million people engaged in producing our food in this country. And he's not saying they're all going to be full-time farmers,
sure,
but again, you're going to have people growing food in their own gardens. You're going to have people doing community gardens in urban centers, et cetera. So that's a part of the new food system that will emerge. And that's already happening. So,
at this point, all these problems notwithstanding, is there still a huge agricultural surplus in this country?
Well, there are surpluses, and again, it depends on how you define surpluses. But, you know, this is another issue in our culture. You know, in the popular media, you see this all the time. How are we going to feed 9 billion people by the year 2050, right? And, of course, the implication is we got to intensify what we're doing to produce more food,
right,
in order to feed all those people, and then the problem's solved. Well, if you look at it on a per-calorie, per-capita basis, we're currently producing enough food to feed 10 billion people. But we're wasting about 40% of the food we produce. And the problem of hunger isn't just a problem of lack of production. It's a problem of poverty. It's a problem of lack of entitlement.
Distribution?
That's a part of that entitlement. And places now where, especially in places like India and Africa, where local people have taken seriously the kind of recommendations that Olivier de Schutter articulated in his UN report called Agroecology and the Right to Food, that when people have the right to food, then a lot of these problems of hunger disappear. Because when they don't have the right to food, they don't have access to their local resources. And we don't work with women, and 70% of the world's farmers, especially in the developing world, are women. And so De Schutter argues you have to work with women if you're going to solve the problem. In places where that's been done, they've actually solved the problem of hunger.
Well, it's been said that because women farmers just tend to be more practical-minded.
Yeah, and they're more focused. You know, the men farmers, when they make a lot of money, they go drink beer someplace. The women farmers, when they make money, they feed their families.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think the agricultural subsidy in this country has a very long future?
That's another really great question. And personally, I think it's going to increasingly be challenged because taxpayers are increasingly saying, you know, why are we providing all of these subsidies to what they call wealthy farmers, which I would dispute a little bit. But nevertheless, that's the perception they have. And they don't see it quite correctly. They don't see it really solving the fundamental problems. And it's simply subsidizing to keep the current system going. And if the current system is increasingly broken, why do we want to keep subsidizing it? And it isn't just agricultural subsidies. It's oil subsidies. You know, ultimately, subsidies are designed to sustain a failed system. And what we should be doing is phasing out subsidies and start to look at investments. Investments are for a short period of time in the public good. And as long as you can demonstrate that an investment of tax dollars is for the public good and moving us in a direction that actually solves problems, that makes sense. Continuing to subsidize things because they don't work without the subsidies doesn't make sense.
Fred Kirschman, you've made a lot of sense during this hour, and it's gone quickly, and it's been very informative and, of course, very open-ended, too.
My pleasure, and you had great questions, huh?
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can be listening next time for University of the Year.